A quick note before we get started. This episode touches on women's health and at times describes instances of bodily and psychological trauma. So we hope you take care when you listen. Reproductive choice, choosing when and how many children to have or none at all. The ability to plan your family size is one of the most economically important strategies women and girls have. Access to contraceptives can help women and girls get an education and participate in the workforce. And according to the United Nations Population Fund, it could also reduce maternal deaths by as much as 3/4. But globally, according to the WHO, nearly 10% of women of childbearing age have unmet contraceptive needs. Most live in low and middle income countries. And teenage girls report less access to contraceptives than any other age group. So how can we close this gap? On today's episode of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, a podcast from Foreign Policy, we look at the most effective ways people are increasing access to family planning services. Later in the show, we'll hear about a global initiative that brings together governments, NGOs, and private sector to improve access to contraceptives. But we'll begin today in West Africa. In 2022, a new action-adventure movie made headlines. The Woman King told the story of an all-female warrior unit. Between the 16th and 19th century, their mandate was to protect the West African kingdom of Dahomey. They fought with lethal bravery.
They are retreating!
The movie is fictional, but based on real-life women living in the West African country of Benin. Today, the descendants of these warrior women are still fighting, but not against armies of invaders, but rather restrictive laws that have limited their opportunities for advancement. A prime example is in women's health. For decades, the country has allowed abortions only under very limited circumstances, meaning that any woman seeking the procedure was forced to prove that she was raped or her life was endangered before being allowed to move forward.
Aucune clinique ne voulait pratiquer l'avortement sur moi.
No clinic wanted to perform an abortion on me. They all refused, saying that the law didn't allow it.
This is a story from Marcella. That's not her real name. She was 18 when she became pregnant. She was a student with limited means, and so she went to an unlicensed practitioner.
La personne qui m'a fait ça, un homme, ça je dois le dire, c'est un homme.
The person who did it to me was a man. The abortion was done on a table, the kind of table on which corpses are laid out in the movies. It was on a table like that I lay, a rusty table. It was a rusty table with no protection whatsoever. No sheets had been put on the table.
Stories like this are really hard to hear, but they are also what fueled a national campaign to provide access to safe abortions in Benin. Reporter Elodie Toto has the story.
While there has long been a call to end unlicensed abortions in Benin, the campaign really started to gain momentum about 6 years ago.
Ça a commencé véritablement en 2018.
It really started in 2018.
This is Dr. Chimon Vodoué. He's a gynecologist and is one of the country's most prominent physicians working in women's health.
Donc c'était plus qu'évident que si véritablement on voulait...
It was more obvious that if we really wanted to limit the serious complications associated with abortion, unsafe abortions, including deaths, it was important to act upstream before admission to health facilities.
Dr. Vodoué and other prominent physicians started a concerted campaign to try and change long-standing gender stereotypes and combat misinformation about abortion. Abortion is quite controversial in Benin because of traditional belief and religion. Christians make up about half of the country's population and have been some of the strongest opponents of legalized abortions, forcing women to get unlicensed treatment. Often, the consequences of these illegal abortions have been disastrous, causing infections, perforation of the uterus and other organs. And sometimes, these complications lead to death. The Beninese government estimates unsafe abortions kill about 200 women a year.
Les histoires, il y en a énormément.
There are so many stories, so many. We had to communicate a lot about this to local elected representatives and opinion leaders, especially those in charge of places of worship and religious leaders.
And the suffering can be mental as well. Marcela, the woman we've heard earlier, told me how even after her abortion was successful, the unlicensed physician she had hired subjected her to emotional trauma.
Il a mis l'embryon, le fœtus dans ce bol et il m'a montré. Il m'a dit de regarder.
He put the embryo, the fetus, in a bowl and he showed it to me and he told me to look. He told me to look and he asked me if I wanted to take it home or if I wanted to flush it down the toilet. I wondered if that was a question to ask usually after the abortion. I didn't answer. When he saw that I was crying, when he saw that maybe I wasn't able to speak, he took it, put it in a bag, and went to pour it down the toilet, making sure that I heard what he was doing.
En me faisant bien entendre ce qu'il était en train de faire.
As terrible as it is to hear the pain of someone like Marcela, it was important for Dr. Vaudouet to recount stories like hers directly to lawmakers. He came to meetings armed with photos and data detailing what girls and women went through.
I can assure you that for this session, many people changed positions. It was almost instantaneous.
Another advantage of Dr. Vaudouet and his fellow activists was access. Of the 22 ministers who make up the government of Benin, 3 are gynecologists. The ministers took advantage of their positions to directly lobby Benin's president, Patrice Talon, and after a sustained campaign, they obtained his support.
Dès lors que le chef d'État, once the head of state, was won over to the cause, that helped enormously.
Finally, after years of working through the hall of parliament, a bill expanding access to safe abortion passed on October 21, 2021. Benin joined Tunisia, South Africa, Zambia, Cape Verde, and Mozambique as the only African countries that allow abortions for any reason up to 12 weeks of pregnancy. Benin's new law also imposes a prison term of up to 20 years for anyone performing an abortion without a license. If it leads to death, the perpetrators risk life imprisonment. Furthermore, practitioners are now bound by professional secrecy and must offer their patients psychological and social support. After the vote, the Minister of Health, Benjamin Ungpatin, hailed the clear-sightedness of the deputies during a press briefing.
Je voudrais saluer la clairvoyance des députés et rassurer la population.
But getting the law passed didn't mean the campaign to expand abortion access was over. Public reaction to the new law was split. Many were overjoyed about these new protections for women's rights, but others felt it discriminated against men and their rights. This has led to difficulties implementing the law, says Bernadette Poe, an advocate for safe abortion.
C'est vrai que aujourd'hui beaucoup.
It's true that many people in our environment here in the north, in Atakora, are not in favor of abortion and tell you so openly.
And in some instances, even healthcare professionals were resistant.
Par moment, vous avez affaire à certains agents.
At times, you have to deal with certain agents who are supposed to facilitate the work, but at times they get emotional, sometimes judgmental, sometimes they don't maintain professional secrecy. So, we have to admit that there are quite a few failures in the system.
Despite these challenges, safe abortions advocates across Benin are working hard to implement the new reforms, and sometimes that requires winning over individuals one by one.
En étant au contact des organisations à base.
By being in direct contact with local organizations, we clearly understand that the community still has issues to access information regarding abortion.
This is Teslanik Undegnon. She's the movement manager with an health advocacy NGO called ODAS. She spends much of her time working with local NGOs and trying to convince facilities to offer abortion services. Teslanik is deliberate in how she talks about abortion, being careful to frame it in the larger context of women's health.
on met un point d'honneur à toujours ajouter sécurisé quand on parle d'avortement.
We make a point of always adding safe when we talk about abortion because it's not just an abortion. Abortions are possible everywhere, but safe abortion in the right condition, with qualified staff, with appropriate equipment, because there are several ways of doing this, but are they accessible? That's all the information they need today.
Teslanik says another challenge in implementing the law is modernizing Benin's under-resourced health system.
Il y a également les enjeux liés à l'offre.
There are also issues linked to the supply of services, but that's not inherent to the abortion issue, but to healthcare in general in terms of health coverage in our country. It's less easy for a woman to access it when she's in a rural area.
And from one clinic to another, the equipment is not the same. For example, I traveled to Cotonou Central Hospital. Conditions seem ideal. The clinic is bright, clean, air-conditioned and reassuring. Patients have their privacy. But once you move away to the suburbs of Cotonou, things are different. Air conditioning becomes a distant memory, as does privacy, and it's hard to source the proper medical equipment. This is the case, for example, in the north of the country, in Natitingo, where Bernard and Paul lives.
Il est important de dire qu'il faut que le gouvernement fasse davantage.
It's important to say that the government needs to do more. When a law is passed, one also needs to make financial arrangements to support this. I think that at times the means are lacking, and this means that at times we have to prioritize certain cases over others. We have to refer others to clinics that charge sums that are a little high in relation to the standard of living.
Paul emphasized that there are not enough practitioners or necessary equipment to provide free abortion to all of those who need it. Now, some women who can't secure appointments at subsidized clinics are paying out of pocket for abortions at private facilities.
You have to be looking at hundreds of thousands of CFA francs, and that's not everyone who has that kind of income. It could be someone's 2 months' salary.
Still, despite these challenges, Bernadette acknowledged that Benin's new law has dramatically improved women's and girls' ability to get safe abortions.
Mais ce qui fait plaisir, c'est que ce n'est plus comme avant.
But the good thing is that it's not like it used to be. If I follow the normal process for access to abortion, I'd have access to an abortion whether you like it or not. So it's a welcome step forward.
5 years ago, when Marcela had her abortion, it was unthinkable to her that a woman could be supported through this ordeal. Today, things have changed.
J'aurais voulu tomber enceinte juste après.
I wish I'd gotten pregnant right after abortion was legalized in Benin, because when I had my abortion, that wasn't the case at all.
So despite the weight of tradition, access to safe abortion is growing in Benin, and so is the feeling of hope and optimism for the future. For the Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, I am Elodie Toto.
Up next, how can we get contraceptives to the 270 million women around the world who don't have them? More on that after the break.
Let's face it, money is the one subject we all need to deal with, but no one actually wants to talk about. The good news is there's a podcast helping you learn everything about money no one taught you. Meet Everyone's Talkin' Money, hosted by me, Shauna Game. Everyone's Talkin' Money focuses on relevant, inclusive, and forward-thinking conversations around money and just helps you get in a better relationship with your money no matter what your goals are. Do yourself a favor and subscribe to Everyone's Talkin' Money podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, a production of Foreign Policy. I'm Rena Ninen. Today's episode, we're focusing on reproductive health. Part of that means preventing unwanted pregnancies. It's becoming a global priority. When the United Nations set its Sustainable Development Goals in 2015, it listed universal access to contraceptives by 2030 as part of the agenda, or SDGs. In the years that have followed, there has been a flurry of work to set this into motion. It's being done by a mixture of government agencies, NGOs, and private donors. Much of this is being coordinated under an umbrella organization called Family Planning 2030, or FP2030. And we should mention that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which supports this podcast, also funds FP2030. I wanted to get a sense of how FP2030's massive coordination efforts work. So I spoke with their executive director, Dr. Samukeliso Dube.
So now, Rina, we just have finalized our new strategy for going towards 2030, and it focuses on four important areas. The first of which is, how does FP2030 as a global movement help countries to normalize family planning? Normalizing family planning for us would start by ensuring that governments across the globe, we could renew and reinvigorate leadership for family planning. It should never be weaponized for political votes or weaponizing policies on advancing family planning. The second pillar is financing. You know, when an agenda is financed, usually from the West or from the global North, is seen as an addendum to the main development agenda. You cannot espouse women's rights. You cannot talk about reducing or eliminating gender-based violence without actually attending to this fundamental human right. But you need to finance that. The third pillar is, who else are we leaving behind? So for us, young people, people living with disabilities, refugees and migrants, ethnic minorities, those are the people when it comes to sexual reproductive health and rights, we are leaving behind. And FP2030 is putting forth this bold agenda of finding those who we are leaving behind. And lastly, in terms of the pillars, it's innovation. What got us here is not going to get us there in 2030 if we don't continuously innovate. We should innovate service delivery models that actually are appealing to young people. We should innovate financing models that are actually going to at least meet the fiscal constraints that many countries are talking about. Also, even the needs in many countries who are saying, we want to manufacture our own contraceptives. How do we innovate and ensure that what women need and what women want is what is being manufactured, is what is being researched? So innovation is key.
I want to also ask you about, you know, so much of this podcast focuses on women's economic empowerment. Why do you think funding family planning is really a smart economic investment in women and girls?
I'm glad you're asking that question because there are many people who have done the investment case, of course, of how much, if you invest so much, this is what you get in return. So on a global scale, we know that ensuring that this human right for everyone, everywhere makes dollars and cents. So we know that investing in voluntary rights-based family planning would save governments money across sectors like in maternal health, general healthcare costs, and many more. For every dollar invested in family planning, the benefits to families and society, they are estimated to be at least $8.78, altogether generating about $660 billion in economic benefits by 2050. Clearly, when we invest in family planning, it's one of those best buys for advancing women's health, for advancing economies, but more importantly, it's a right. So there is obviously the cost-saving argument, there is the return on investment argument, as I've alluded to the figures, but it also allows governments, it allows people to actually plan in advance on what kind of a country they do want to see in terms of population growth and population dynamics. Without that planning, it is difficult for countries to really see the gain from a demographic dividend perspective, from a health gains perspective, and from a women's economic empowerment perspective. That's the message that we send to ministries of finance and even the global financing community as to why this is important.
What do you find are really the biggest barriers to accessing contraceptives?
We still have about 217 million women today who want to prevent pregnancy, but they may not have means or knowledge to do so. And that for me is a scary figure. So what we are finding across our work is that we still have huge policy barriers for access to family planning. And these mainly, largely they stem from rigid gender norms or insufficient funding. And then we are seeing that many governments across the globe They are battling the crisis of teenage pregnancies that is very high in many countries. But we are also seeing that there are many places in the world where there are no commodities, or commodities are very expensive, or the method that is available for women is not conducive to what they want. Now, Rina, imagine a world where we match what women need, what women want, and what women can have, and making sure that the demand side of the equation is matched with the supply side of the equation, we will really overcome some of these barriers. And again, FP2030 has been working hard to build up many young people to be leaders and ambassadors of the broad range of comprehensive sexual health and rights in their communities, including faith-based communities, to help us dismantle some of these social and gender norms that are rigid and that are prohibiting women and even men at times from accessing family planning methods or even contraception.
Talk to me a little bit more about getting through social norms around contraception, particularly for girls. How do you work around that culturally in different areas?
So for us, as I mentioned before, we do have a pillar that focuses on young people. Young people, when they are at the table, that is the starting point. When they're invited in the room and they are given a voice, they would actually demand more from the policy makers and the ones who actually are bearers of power in terms of dismantling some of those social norms. Just where I'm sitting in South Africa, they have recently launched, you know, like a mobile vending machines where somebody can actually, with a prescription or without a prescription, could access short-acting methods, or with a prescription, they could access long-acting methods. Because young people, in terms of their nature, may not want to go and queue in a facility because, again, of those norms that are entrenched in society. So that's, again, working with our partners, working through focal points, who are working with youth, we are seeing progress in that particular area. But again, going back to the very existential question around leadership, who can lead better? And so FP2030, working across many countries, we are looking for those leaders who could champion a different and a better cause for young people, for adolescents, for policies around youth in their countries, so that we can have a better and more progressive environment.
Can you talk to me, Dr. Dubey, a little bit about the cost of contraception? What have you found in your experience? Is that a barrier for women and girls accessing contraception?
So you find that cost in terms of the direct purchase of the contraception may not necessarily be a barrier. But remember that costs are direct and maybe indirect. So the cost of going to a facility, for example, the opportunity costs of not going to work, for example, those are still costs that need us to innovate better. And that's why we support, as FP2030, self-care methods that could be cheaper and could be readily available at a woman's doorstep. She can administer on her own, and the price actually would be better off than other methods that we are seeing across the globe. So when you look at other countries, for example, in Latin America, we know that long-acting methods are still a challenge in terms of the reach, because many people have got private healthcare insurance. Maybe they could access these methods. But there are methods that are as expensive as $100 or even $200. And for example, there was only one country in 2012, Burkina Faso, where implants were the most commonly used method of contraception. Today, implants are the most commonly used method in 11 countries and second most commonly used method in another 16 countries. And this is a result of the work funded by the Gates Foundation and others through the volume guarantees that actually happened. It's a startling transformation, right? And this started as a result of the Implant Access Program. It was a public-private partnership which helped halve the price of contraceptive implants in the countries that had made an FP2020 commitment then. And they accessed this through volume guarantees. And it's actually an interesting case study of where private sector could come in to make big bets and solve some of these societal challenges. So that's how it actually became the norm.
According to data from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, nearly 40% of women who begin using contraceptives actually stop within the first year because they're not happy with the method they're using. Why is this the case? What have you found?
So it's mainly they may want to return to fertility, but some of them, they say it's because they are not very happy with the method. They think there are side effects. But some of them is frankly, and what we have seen in many countries, is lack of information. So as a community of family planning practitioners, many people have invested a lot of money in quality counseling so that women can anticipate some of the side effects of the method that they are using and do not discontinue. But where the numbers are large, we know we need to investigate our own programs to understand them better and to match the demand versus with the right supply at any given time. We have seen that postpartum family planning, when a woman has given birth, has the greatest opportunity that we can have for increasing uptake to family planning. It's high impact practices, including how are you going to deal with youth? I mentioned the vending machines for contraceptives that are happening in some countries. Also how you tackle social norms is a high impact practice that actually is being scaled up across the globe.
Are there any innovations in the contraceptive field that you want to tell our listeners about?
Yes, indeed. The Gates Foundation is investing more of the downstream research, looking at non-hormonal methods, so there is growth in that area. We are also seeing investment in the male contraceptive pill. Again, it's actually sort of appealing to some audiences. We are seeing countries now adopting self-care methods, like the self-injectable the subcutaneous that actually came out of research a few years ago, South Africa being one country that wants to adopt that. Again, it speaks to what is it that women need? What is it that they want and what is it that they can have? So we are seeing advances in that.
Dr. Dubey, my last question for you. What do you think is most needed right now to increase access to family planning?
I think I would put my money on renewing and reinvigorating leadership for family planning. We need leadership for financing. We need leadership for health systems change. We need leadership as we talk about universal health coverage to make sure family planning is part of that. We are still stuck with a number to make sure that many countries contribute at least 1% of their health budget should go to family planning and especially procurement of commodities. So I am sure that if we reinvigorate leadership that is bold, that is decisive, that does not weaponize sexual reproductive health and rights, we will solve many of the fundamental systemic challenges that exist in terms of access to family planning.
Dr. Dubey, I want to thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your time as well.
Next week on the podcast, how a group of girls in India is stopping child marriage among their peers.
I told them, I don't want to get married. I want to study and stand on my own feet.
That episode, next week. And that does it for today's show. The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women is a production of Foreign Policy and is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Roberta Buffett Institute for Global Affairs at Northwestern University. The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women is hosted by me, Rena Ninen. Laura Rosbrow-Tellum is our senior producer. Rob Sachs, our managing director. Nicholas Petrie-Mitchell provided production assistance, and Elodie Toto contributed reporting for this episode. Maiwa Aina read the English voiceover for Marcella, and Speechify created the other interviewees' voices in English. Our thanks to you, and we'll be back in your feed next week.